Chapter 4. Oh, a woman, said Flamel, negligently. Glenard was nettled by his obvious loss of interest. Rather think they'd attract a good deal of notice, if they were published. Flamel still looked uninterested. Oh, letters, I suppose? Oh, just the letters a woman would write to a man she knew well. They were tremendous friends, he and she. And she wrote a clever letter? Clever? It was Margaret Aubyn. A great silence filled the room. It seemed to Glenard that the words had burst from him as blood gushes from a wound. Great Scott! Said Flamel, sitting up. Collection of Margaret Aubyn's letters? Did you say you had them? They were left me by my friend. I see. Was he well? No matter. You're to be congratulated, at any rate. What are you going to do with them? Glenard stood up with a sense of weariness in all his bones. Oh, I don't know. I haven't thought much about it. I just happened to see that some fellow was writing her life, Jocelyn. Yes. You didn't think of giving them to him? Glenard had lounged across the room, and stood staring up at a bronze Bacchus who drooped his garlanded head above the pediment of an Italian cabinet. Had ought I to do? You're just the fellow to advise me. He felt the blood in his cheek as he spoke. Flamel sat with meditative eye. What do you want to do with them? He asked. I want to publish them, said Glenard, swinging round with sudden energy. If I can, if you can. They're yours, you say? They're mine fast enough. There's no one to prevent. I mean, there are no restrictions. He was arrested by the sense that these accumulated proofs of impunity might precisely stand as the strongest check on his action. And Mrs. Aubyn had no family, I believe? No. Then I don't see who's to interfere, said Flamel, studying his cigar tip. Glenard had turned his unseeing stare on an ecstatic St. Catherine framed in tarnished gilding. It's just this way, he began again, with an effort. Hen letters are as personal as these of my friends. ... Well, I don't mind telling you that the cash would make a heap of difference to me. Such a lot, that it rather obscures my judgment. The fact is, if I could lay my hand on a few thousands now, I could get into a big thing, and without appreciable risk. And I'd like to know whether you think I'd be justified under the circumstances. ... He paused, with a dry throat. It seemed to him at the moment that it would be impossible for him ever to sink lower in his own estimation. He was in truth less ashamed of weighing the temptation than of submitting his scruples to a man like Flamel, and affecting to appeal to sentiments of delicacy on the absence of which he had consciously reckoned. But he had reached a point where each word seemed to compel another, as each wave in a stream is forced forward by the pressure behind it, and before Flamel could speak he had faltered out, "Who, don't think people could say. ... could criticize the man. ... but the man's dead, isn't he? He's dead, yes. But can I assume the responsibility without?" Flamel hesitated. And almost immediately Glenard's scruples gave way to irritation. If at this hour Flamel were to affect an inopportune reluctance, the older man's answer reassured him. I need you assume any responsibility? Your name won't appear, of course. And as to your friends, I don't see why it should either. He wasn't a celebrity himself, I suppose? No, no. Then the letters can be addressed to Mr. Blank. Doesn't that make it all right? Glenard's hesitation revived. Or the public, yes. But I don't see that it alters the case for me. The question is, ought I to publish them at all? Of course you ought to. Flamel spoke with invigorating emphasis. Doubt if you'd be justified in keeping them back. Anything of Margaret Aubyn's is more or less public property by this time. She's too great for any one of us. I was only wondering how you could use them to the best advantage to yourself. I mean, how many are there? Oh, a lot. Perhaps 100 I haven't counted. There may be more. ... Gad. What a haul. When were they written? I don't know, that is, they corresponded for years. What's the odds? He moved toward his hat with a vague impulse of flight. "It all counts," said Flamel, imperturbably. "Long correspondence one, I mean, that covers a great deal of time is obviously worth more than if the same number of letters had been written within a year. At any rate, you won't give them to Jocelyn? They'd fill a book, wouldn't they?"
"I suppose so. I don't know how much it takes to fill a book."
"Not love letters, you say? Why?" flashed from Glenard. "Oh, nothing, only the big public is sentimental, and if they were, why, you could get any money for Margaret Aubin's love letters." Glenard was silent.
"Are the letters interesting in themselves? I mean, apart from the association with her name?"
"I'm no judge." Glenard took up his hat and thrust himself into his overcoat.
"Dare say I shan't do anything about it.
And, Flamel, you won't mention this to anyone?"
"Lord, no."
"Well, I congratulate you. You've got a big thing." Flamel was smiling at him from the hearth. Glenard, on the threshold, forced a response to the smile, while he questioned with loitering indifference financially, "Eh?
Rather, I should say so."
Glenard's hand lingered on the knob. "How much should you say? You know about such things."
"Oh, I should have to see the letters. But I should say, well, if you've got enough to fill a book, and they're fairly readable, and the book is brought out at the right time, say 10,000 down from the publisher, and possibly one or two more in royalties.
If you got the publishers bidding against each other, you might do even better. But of course I'm talking in the dark."
"Of course," said Glenard, with sudden dizziness.
His hand had slipped from the knob, and he stood staring down at the exotic spirals of the Persian rug beneath his feet.
"I'd have to see the letters," Flamel repeated.
"Of course you'd have to see them."
... Glenard stammered, and, without turning, he flung over his shoulder an inarticulate goodbye.
The little house, as Glenard strolled up to it between the trees, seemed no more than a gay tent pitched against the sunshine. It had the crispness of a freshly starched summer gown, and the geraniums on the veranda bloomed as simultaneously as the flowers in a bonnet. The garden was prospering absurdly. Seeds they had sown at random amid laughing countercharges of incompetence had shot up in fragrant defiance of their blunders. He smiled to see the clematis unfolding its punctual wings about the porch. The tiny lawn was smooth as a shaven cheek, and a crimson rambler mounted to the nursery window of a baby who never cried. A breeze shook the awning above the tea table, and his wife, as he drew near, could be seen bending above a kettle that was just about to boil. So vividly did the whole scene suggest the painted bliss of a stage setting, that it would have been hardly surprising to see her step forward among the flowers and trill out her virtuous happiness from the veranda rail. The stale heat of the long day in town, the moldy promiscuity of the suburban train were now but the requisite foil to an evening of scented breezes and tranquil talk. They had been married more than a year, and each homecoming still reflected the freshness of their first day together. If, indeed, their happiness had a flaw, it was in resembling too closely the bright impermanence of their surroundings. Their love as yet was but the gay tent of holiday makers. His wife looked up with a smile. The country life suited her, and her beauty had gained depth from a stillness in which certain faces might have grown opaque.
"Are you very tired?" she asked, pouring his tea.
"Just enough to enjoy this." He rose from the chair in which he had thrown himself, and bent over the tray for his cream.
"You've had a visitor?" he commented, noticing a half-empty cup beside her own.
"Only Mr. Flamel," she said, indifferently.
"Flamel? Again?"
she answered without show of surprise.
"He left just now. His yacht is down at Laurel Bay and he borrowed a trap of the Dreshams to drive over here."
Glenard made no comment, and she went on, leaning her head back against the cushions of her bamboo seat. "He wants us to go for a sail with him next Sunday."
Glenard meditatively stirred his tea. He He was trying to think of the most natural and unartificial thing to say, and his voice seemed to come from the outside, as though he were speaking behind a marionette.
Oh, you want to?
Just as you please, she said, compliantly. No affectation of indifference could have been as baffling as her compliance. Glenard, of late, was beginning to feel that the surface which, a year ago, he had taken for a sheet of clear glass, might, after all, be a mirror reflecting merely his own conception of what lay behind it.
Do you like flannel? He suddenly asked,
to which, still engaged with her tea, she returned the feminine answer, thought you did.
I do, of course, he agreed, vexed at his own incorrigible tendency to magnify flannel's importance by hovering about the topic.
Sale would be rather jolly, let's go. She made no reply, and he drew forth the rolled-up evening papers which he had thrust into his pocket on leaving the train. As he smoothed them out, his own countenance seemed to undergo the same process. He ran his eye down the list of stocks, and Flamel's importunate personality receded behind the rows of figures pushing forward into notice like so many bearers of good news. Glenard's investments were flowering like his garden. The driest shares blossomed into dividends, and a golden harvest awaited his sickle. He glanced at his wife with the tranquil air of the man who digests good luck as naturally as the dry ground absorbs a shower. Things are looking uncommonly well. I believe we shall be able to go to town for 2 or 3 months next winter, if we can find something cheap. She smiled luxuriously. It was pleasant to be able to say, with an air of balancing relative advantages, really, on the baby's account I shall be almost sorry, but if we do go, there's Kate Erskine's house. She'll let us have it for almost nothing. Well, write her about it, he recommended, his eyes traveling on in search of the weather report. He had turned to the wrong page, and suddenly a line of black characters leapt out at him, as from an ambush. Margaret Aubin's letters. ...2 volumes. Out today. First edition of 5,000 sold out before leaving the press. Second edition ready next week. The book of the year. He looked up stupidly. His wife still sat with her head thrown back, her pure profile detached against the cushions. She was smiling a little over the prospect his last words had opened. Behind her head, shivers of sun and shade ran across the striped awning. A row of maples and a privet hedge hid their neighbor's gables, giving them undivided possession of their leafy half acre. And life, a moment before, had been like their plot of ground, shut off, hedged in from importunities, impenetrably his and hers. Now it seemed to him that every maple leaf, every privet bud, was a relentless human gaze, pressing close upon their privacy. It was as though they sat in a brightly lit room, uncurtained from a darkness full of hostile watchers. His wife still smiled, and her unconsciousness of danger seemed, in some horrible way, to put her beyond the reach of rescue. He had not known that it would be like this. After the first odious weeks, spent in preparing the letters for publication, in submitting them to Flamel, and in negotiating with the publishers, the transaction had dropped out of his consciousness into that unvisited limbo to which we relegate the deeds we would rather not have done, but have no notion of undoing. From the moment he had obtained Miss Trent's promise not to sail with her aunt, he had tried to imagine himself irrevocably committed. After that, he argued, his first duty was to her as he had become his conscience. The sum obtained from the publishers by Flamel's adroit manipulations, and opportunely transferred to Dinslow's successful venture, already yielded a return which, combined with Glenard's professional earnings, took the edge of compulsion from their way of living, making it appear the expression of a graceful Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.